other nonverbal behaviors of the face. Furrowed forehead. Frowning by furrowing the forehead and brow usually occurs when a person is anxious, sad, concentrating, concerned, bewildered, or angry, as shown in Figure 83. A forehead furrow needs to be examined in context to determine its true meaning. For instance, I saw a supermarket cashier closing out her register drawer, frowning as she went about counting her cash. You could see the intensity and concentration of her expression as she tried to square the totals at the end of her shift. The same frown can be observed in someone who has just been arrested and is being led out past reporters. The furrowed forehead is usually present when someone finds himself in an untenable or disagreeable situation but can't escape, which is why you usually see it on arrest mugshots. Incidentally, this frowning behavior is so ancient and so common to mammals that even dogs will recognize it when we look at them with a furrowed brow. Dogs themselves can exhibit a similar expression when they are anxious, sad, or concentrating. Another interesting fact with regard to frowning is that as we get older and add to our life experiences, our foreheads develop deeper and deeper furrows that eventually become permanent wrinkles. Just as permanent smile lines may develop from a lifetime of positive nonverbals and signify a happy life, a person with a wrinkled brow likely has had a challenging life in which he engaged in frequent frowning. Nasal wing dilation, nose flare. As discussed previously, the flaring of nostrils is a facial cue that signals that a person is aroused. Lovers can often be seen hovering around each other, their nostrils subtly flaring in excitement and anticipation. Most likely, lovers engage in this subconscious behavior as they absorb each other's sense of sexual attraction, known as pheromones. Nose flaring is also an intention cue, a potent indicator of the intent to do something physical, and not necessarily sexual. It can be anything from getting ready to climb some steep stairs to preparing to move a bookcase. As people prepare to act physically, they will oxygenate, which causes the nostrils to flare. As a law enforcement officer, if I encounter a person on the street looking down, his feet in the ready or pugilistic position, with his nose flaring, I suspect that he is probably preparing to do one of three things: argue, run, or fight. Nasal wing dilation is something you should always be watching for if you are around someone who might have reason either to attack or run away from you. It is just one of many suspicious behaviors we should teach our children to watch for. That way, they will be more aware when people are becoming dangerous, especially at school or on playgrounds. Nail biting and related signs of stress. If you see a person biting his nails while waiting to close a deal, he probably does not impress you as being very confident. Nail biting is an indication of stress, insecurity, or discomfort. When you see it in a bargaining session, even if just for a moment, it is safe to assume that the nail biter is unsure of himself and/or is bargaining from a position of weakness. People interviewing for jobs or young men waiting for their dates to arrive should avoid biting their nails, not only because it looks unsightly, but also because nail biting shouts, "I am insecure." We bite our nails not because they need trimming primarily, but rather because it pacifies us. Facial blushing and blanching. Sometimes we will involuntarily blush or blanch based on deep emotional states. To demonstrate blushing behavior in my classes, I will make a student stand in front of the group, and then I will come up behind and get very close to the back of his or her neck. Usually, this violation of the person's space will be enough to cause a limbic reaction, making the face blush. On some people, especially fair-skinned individuals, this can be very noticeable. People will also blush when they are caught doing something they know is wrong. Then there is the blushing that occurs when a person likes someone but doesn't want him or her to know it. Teenagers who harbor a secret crush on someone will often blush when that particular person draws near. This is a true limbic response that is transmitted by the body and is relatively easy to spot. Conversely, blanching, turning pale, can take place when we are in the sustained limbic reaction known as shock. I have seen blanching as a result of a traffic accident, or in an interview in which a person was suddenly presented with overwhelming evidence of his guilt. Blanching takes place as the involuntary nervous system hijacks all the surface vessels and channels the blood to our larger muscles to prepare for escape or attack. I know of at least one case where an individual was so surprised to be arrested that he suddenly blanched and had a fatal heart attack. Although these behaviors are only skin deep, we should not ignore them, as they are indicative of high stress and will present differently according to the nature and the duration of the circumstances. Disapproval cues through facial expressions. Disapproval cues vary around the world and reflect a specific culture's social norms. In Russia, I have had people look at me with scorn because I was whistling while walking down the hallway of an art museum. It seems that whistling indoors is a no-no in Russia. In Montevideo, I was among a group that was sanctioned with squinting eyes, followed by a dismissive turn of the face away. Apparently, our group was talking too loudly, and locals did not appreciate our boisterous humor. In the United States, because the country is so large and diverse, different locales will have different disapproval displays. What you see in the Midwest is different from what you see in New England or New York. Most disapproval displays show on the face and are among the earliest messages we learn from our parents and siblings. Those who care for us will give us that face to let us know if we are doing something wrong or getting out of line. My father, who is very stoic, had the look down pat. All he had to do was glance at me sternly, and that was enough. It was a look that even my friends feared. The man never had to castigate us verbally. He just gave us that unmistakable glance, and that was it. For the most part, we are fairly adept at understanding disapproval cues, although at times they can be very subtle. Recognizing censure is a key to learning the unwritten rules and conventions of a country or area, as it conveys when we have broken them. These signals help us know when we are being rude. Undeserved and inappropriate displays of disapproval or censure, however, are likewise rude. One nonverbal of disapproval too commonly seen in America is rolling of the eyes. This is a sign of disrespect and must not be tolerated, especially from subordinates, staff, or children. Facial displays of disgust or disapproval are very honest and are reflective of what is going on in the brain. Disgust likely registers primarily on the face, because this is the part of our anatomy that was adapted over millions of years to reject spoiled food or anything else that might harm us. Although these facial displays may range from muted to obvious, whether confronted with negative or displeasing information, or when tasting bad food, as far as the brain is concerned, the sentiment is the same. I don't like this. Get it away from me. No matter how slight the grimace or look of distaste or displeasure, we can be confident in interpreting these behaviors accurately, because they are governed by the limbic system. A watered-down sales pitch. Not long ago, I was approached by a saleswoman for a major chain of gyms in Central Florida. The young lady was very enthusiastic to have me join the gym, stating it would only cost me $1 a day for the rest of the year. As I listened, she became even more animated, as I think she saw me as a good prospect. When it was my turn to speak, I asked if the gym had a pool. She said no, but that it had other great features. I then mentioned that currently I paid $22 per month to attend my gym and that it had an Olympic-sized pool. As I spoke, She looked down at her feet while making a micro-gesture of disgust. Her nose and the left side of her mouth lifted upward, as depicted in Figure 84. It was a short and fleeting gesture, and if it had lasted longer, it would have looked like a snarl. This micro-gesture was enough for me to know that she was displeased with what I said, and after a second or two, she made an excuse to leave me and approach someone else. Sales pitch over. That was neither the first nor the last time I observed such behavior. In fact, I have often seen it in negotiations, where an offer is made and one of the participants involved suddenly and without conscious thought made a similar micro-gesture of disgust. When rejecting food being tendered in Latin America, it is very common to perform this behavior while shaking the head side to side without saying a word. Interestingly, what is seen as rude in one setting or country may be a perfectly acceptable gesture in another. The key to successful travel is to know the customs in advance, so you know what to do and what to expect. Till disgust do us part. Just how accurate is this disgust gesture in revealing our inner thoughts and intentions? Here's a personal example. While I was visiting with a friend and his fiancée, he spoke of their upcoming marriage and honeymoon plans. Unbeknownst to him, I witnessed her make a facial micro-gesture of disgust as he uttered the word marriage. It was an extremely fleeting gesture, and I thought it odd, since the topic appeared to be something about which both of them should have been excited. Months later, my friend called to tell me that his fiancée had backed out of the wedding. I had seen, in that single gesture, her brain registering its true sentiments without equivocation. The thought of going through with the marriage was repulsive to her. Gravity-defying behaviors of the face. The old adage, "keep your chin up," is a remark directed at someone who is in the doldrums or experiencing misfortune. This bit of folk wisdom accurately reflects our limbic response to adversity. A person with his chin down is seen as lacking confidence and experiencing negative sentiments, while a person with his chin up is perceived as being in a positive frame of mind. This is demonstrated in figures 85 and 86 of the PDF. What is true with the chin is also true for the nose. A nose-up gravity-defying gesture is a high-confidence nonverbal tell, while a nose-down position is a display of low confidence. When people are stressed or upset, the chin and nose, since it must follow along, tends not to be held high. Tucking the chin is a form of withdrawal or distancing and can be very accurate in discerning true negative sentiment. In Europe, in particular, you see a lot more of these behaviors, especially holding the nose high when looking down on those of lower class or snubbing someone. I was watching French television while traveling abroad and noted how one politician, when asked a question he deemed beneath him, merely raised his nose high, looking down on the reporter, and answered, "No, I will not answer that." The nose reflected his status and attitude of contempt for the reporter. Charles de Gaulle, a rather complex individual who eventually became the president of France, was famous for projecting this kind of haughty attitude and image. The rule of mixed signals. Sometimes we don't say what we're really thinking, but our faces reflect it anyway. For example, someone who is looking repeatedly at his watch, or at the nearest exit, is letting you know he is either running late, has an appointment, or would rather be elsewhere. This kind of look is an intention cue. Other times, we say one thing, but really believe otherwise. This brings us to a general rule when it comes to interpreting emotions and or words by looking at facial expressions. When confronted with mixed signals from the face, such as happiness cues along with anxiety signals or pleasure behaviors seen alongside displeasure displays, or if the verbal and nonverbal facial messages are not in agreement, always side with the negative emotion as the more honest of the two. The negative sentiment will almost always be the more accurate and genuine of the person's feelings and emotions. For instance, if someone says, "So happy to see you," with jaws tightened, the statement is false. The tension in the face reveals the true emotion the person is feeling. Why side with the negative emotion? Because our most immediate reaction to an objectionable situation is usually the most accurate. It is only after a moment, when we realize that others might see us, that we mask that initial response with some facial behavior that is more socially acceptable. So when confronted with both, go with the first emotion observed, especially if it is a negative emotion. Concluding thoughts on the face. Because the face can convey so many different expressions, and because we are taught to mask our facial displays at an early age, anything you observe on the face should be compared with the nonverbals of the rest of the body. In addition, because facial cue behaviors are so complex, it may be difficult to interpret whether they reflect comfort or discomfort. If you are confused as to the meaning of a facial expression, reenact it and sense how it makes you feel. You will find this little trick may help you decipher what you just observed. The face can reveal a great deal of information, but it can also mislead. You need to look for clusters of behaviors, constantly evaluate what you see in its context, and note whether the facial expression agrees with or is in contrast to signals from other parts of the body. Only by performing all of these observations can you confidently validate your assessment of a person's emotions and intentions. 8. Detecting deception. Proceed with caution. Throughout the book, we've touched on many examples of nonverbal behavior, the body signals we can utilize to better understand the feelings, thoughts, and intentions of others. By now, I hope you have been persuaded that with these nonverbal clues, you can accurately assess what every body is saying in any setting. There is, however, one type of human behavior that is difficult to read, and that is deception. You might assume that as a career FBI agent, who has at times been called a human lie detector, I can spot deceit with relative ease, and even teach you to become a personal polygraph in short order. Nothing could be further from the truth. In reality, it is extremely difficult to detect deception, far more so than getting an accurate read on the other behaviors we have discussed throughout this book. It is precisely because of my experience as an FBI agent involved in behavioral analysis, a person who has spent his entire career attempting to detect lies, that I recognize and appreciate the difficulties in accurately assessing deceptive behavior. It is also for that reason that I have chosen to devote an entire chapter and to end this book with a realistic appraisal and application of nonverbal behaviors in detecting deception. Lots of books have been written on this subject that make it sound easy, even for amateurs. I assure you, it is not. I believe this is the first time a career law enforcement and counterintelligence officer with a considerable background in this field and who still teaches in the intelligence community has stepped forward to sound this warning. Most people, both laypersons and professionals, are not very good at detecting lies. Why make this statement? Because unfortunately, I have seen too many investigators misinterpret nonverbal behaviors over the years, making innocent people feel culpable or unnecessarily uncomfortable. I have also seen both amateurs and professionals make claims that are outrageous, ruining lives in the process. Too many people have gone to jail for giving false confessions just because an officer mistook a stress response for a lie. Newspapers are replete with horror stories, including the one about the New York Central Park jogger, wherein officers mistook nonverbals of stress for deception and pressured the innocent into confessions. It is my hope that those who listen to this book will have a more realistic and honest picture of what can and cannot be achieved through the nonverbal approach to detecting deception. And armed with this knowledge, they will take a more reasoned, cautious approach to declaring when a person is or is not telling the truth. Deception, a topic worthy of study. We all have a stake in the truth. Society functions based on an assumption that people will abide by their word, that truth prevails over mendacity. For the most part, it does. If it didn't, relationships would have a short shelf life, commerce would cease, and trust between parents and children would be destroyed. All of us depend on honesty, because when truth is lacking, we suffer, and society suffers. When Adolf Hitler lied to Neville Chamberlain, there was not peace in our time, and over 50 million people paid the price with their lives. When Richard Nixon lied to the nation, it destroyed the respect many had for the office of the president. When Enron executives lied to their employees, thousands of lives were ruined overnight. We count on our government and commercial institutions to be honest and truthful. We need and expect our friends and family to be truthful. Truth is essential for all relations, be they personal, professional, or civic. We are fortunate that, for the most part, people are honest, and that most of the lies we hear daily are actually social or white lies, meant to protect us from the true answer to questions such as, "Do I look fat in this outfit?" Unquestionably, when it comes to more serious matters, it is in our own self-interest to assess and determine the truth of what we are told. Achieving this, however, is not easy. For thousands of years, people have been using soothsayers and all manner of dubious techniques, such as putting a hot knife on a person's tongue, to detect deception. Even today, some organizations use handwriting samples, voice stress analysis, or the polygraph to spot liars. All of these methods have questionable results. There is no method, no machine to test, no person that is 100% accurate at uncovering deception. Even the vaunted polygraph is accurate only 60 to 80% of the time, depending on the operator of the instrument. Looking for liars. The truth is that identifying deceit is so difficult that repeated studies begun in the 1980s show that most of us, including judges, attorneys, clinicians, police officers, FBI agents, politicians, teachers, mothers, fathers, and spouses, are no better than chance 50-50 when it comes to detecting deception. It is disturbing, but true. Most people, including professionals, do no better than a coin toss at correctly perceiving dishonesty. Even those who are truly gifted at detecting deception, probably less than 1% of the general population, seldom are right more than 60% of the time. Consider the countless jurors who must determine honesty or dishonesty, guilt or innocence, based on what they think are deceptive behaviors. Unfortunately, those behaviors most often mistaken for dishonesty are primarily manifestations of stress, not deception. That's why I live by the motto taught to me by those who know that there is no single behavior that is indicative of deception, not one. This does not mean that we should abandon our efforts to study deception and observe for behaviors that, in context, are suggestive of it. My advice is to set a realistic goal, to be able to read nonverbal behaviors with clarity and reliability, and let the human body speak to you as to what it is thinking, feeling, or intending. These are more reasonable objectives that, in the end, will not only help you understand others more effectively, lying isn't the only behavior worth detecting, but will also give you clues to deception as a byproduct of your observations. What makes deception so difficult to detect? If you're wondering why identifying deception is so difficult, consider the old adage, practice makes perfect. We learn to lie at such an early age, and we do it so often, that we become skillful at telling falsehoods convincingly. To illustrate, think of how often you have heard something like, "Tell them we are not home," or "Put on a party smile," or "Don't tell your dad what happened, or we'll both be in trouble." Because we are social animals, we not only lie for our own benefit, but we lie for the benefit of each other. Lying can be a way to avoid giving a lengthy explanation, an attempt to avoid punishment, a shortcut to a bogus doctoral degree, or it can simply be used to be nice. Even our cosmetics and padded clothing help us to deceive. In essence, for us humans, lying is a tool for social survival. A new approach to uncovering deception. During my last year at the FBI, I submitted my research and findings on deception, including a review of the literature for the previous 40 years. This led to the FBI publication of an article entitled, "A Four-Domain Model of Detecting Deception, an Alternative Paradigm for Interviewing." This paper presented a new model for identifying dishonesty, based on the concept of limbic arousal and our displays of comfort and discomfort, or the comfort-discomfort domain. Simply put, I suggested that when we are telling the truth and have no worries, we tend to be more comfortable than when we are lying or concerned about getting caught because we harbor guilty knowledge. The model also shows how we tend to display more emphatic behaviors when we are comfortable and truthful, and when we are uncomfortable, we don't. This model is currently being used worldwide, although its purpose was to train law enforcement officers to detect deception during criminal investigations. It is applicable to any type of interpersonal interaction, at work, at home, or anywhere in which differentiating dishonesty from truth is important. As I present it to you here, you'll be uniquely prepared to understand it because of what you have learned in previous chapters. The critical role of the comfort-discomfort equation in detecting deception. Those who are lying or are guilty, and must carry the knowledge of their lies and or crimes with them, find it difficult to achieve comfort, and their tension and distress may be readily observed. Attempting to disguise their guilt or deception places a very distressing cognitive load on them as they struggle to fabricate answers to what would otherwise be simple questions. The more comfortable a person is when speaking with us, the easier it will be to detect the critical nonverbals of discomfort associated with deception. Your goal is to establish high comfort during the early part of any interaction or during rapport building. This helps you to establish a baseline of behaviors during that period when the person, hopefully, does not feel threatened. Establishing a comfort zone for detecting deception. In pursuing the detection of deception, you must realize your impact on the actions of a suspected liar, and recognize that how you behave will affect the other person's behavior. How you ask the questions, accusingly. How you sit, too close. How you look upon the person, suspiciously, will either support or disrupt their comfort level. It is well established that if you violate people's space, if you act suspicious, if you look at them the wrong way, or ask questions with a prosecutorial tone, it negatively intrudes on the interview. First and foremost, unmasking liars is not about identifying dishonesty, but rather it is about how you observe and question others in order to detect deception. Then, it is about the collection of nonverbal intelligence. The more you see, clusters of behavior, the more confidence you can have in your observations, and the greater your chances for perceiving when someone is being untruthful. Even if you are actively looking for deception during a discussion or interview, your role should be neutral, to the extent possible, not suspicious. Remember that the moment you become suspicious, you are affecting how a person will respond to you. If you say, "You are lying," or I think you are not telling the truth, or even simply look at him or her suspiciously, you will influence the person's behaviors. The best way to proceed is just to ask for ever more clarifying details about the matter, such as a simple, "I don't understand," or "Can you explain how that happened again?" Often merely getting someone to expand on his or her statement will suffice in eventually sorting deceit from truth. Whether you are attempting to ascertain the validity of someone's credentials during an employment interview, the truth about a theft at work, or especially if you are engaged in a serious discussion regarding finances or potential infidelity with your spouse, keeping your cool is essential. Try to remain calm as you ask questions. Don't act suspicious, and appear comfortable and non-judgmental. That way, the person you are speaking with will be less likely to be defensive and/or unwilling to divulge information. Defining signs of comfort. Comfort is readily apparent in conversations with family and friends. We sense when people are having a good time and are comfortable in our presence. While seated at a table, people who are comfortable with each other will move objects aside so that nothing blocks their view. Over time, they may draw closer so they do not have to talk as loudly. Individuals who are comfortable display their bodies more openly, showing more of their torsos and the insides of their arms and legs. They allow ventral access or fronting. In the presence of strangers, comfort is more difficult to achieve, especially in stressful situations, such as a formal interview or a deposition. That is why it's so important that you do your best to create a comfort zone from the very outset of your interaction with another individual. When we are comfortable, there should be synchrony in our nonverbal behavior. The breathing rhythm of two comfortable people will be similar, as will the tone and pitch of their speech and their general demeanor. Just think of a couple leaning toward each other at a cafe as they sit in full comfort. If one leans forward, the other follows, the phenomenon known as isopraxism. If a person is standing while talking to us, leaning to the side with hands in the pockets and feet crossed, most likely we will do the same, as is shown in Figure 87 of the PDF. By mirroring another person's behavior, we are subconsciously saying, "I am comfortable with you." In an interview setting, or any situation where a difficult topic is being discussed, the tone of each party should mirror the other over time, if there is synchrony. If harmony does not exist between the people involved, this synchrony will be missing and discernible. They may sit differently, talk in a manner or tone different from each other, or at least their expressions will be at odds, if not totally disparate. Asynchrony is a barrier to effective communication and is a serious obstacle to a successful interview or discussion. If you are relaxed and poised during a conversation or interview, while the other party continually looks at the clock or sits in a way that is tense or lacks movement, referred to as flash frozen, this is suggestive that there is no comfort, even though to the untrained eye, it may appear that everything is all right. If the other person seeks disruptions or talks repeatedly of finalizing the conversation, these too are signs of discomfort. Obviously, displays of comfort are more common in people speaking the truth. There is no stress to conceal, and no guilty knowledge to make them uncomfortable. Thus, you should be looking for signs of discomfort, when they occur, and in what context, to assess for possible deception. Signs of discomfort in an interaction. We show discomfort when we do not like what is happening to us, when we do not like what we are seeing or hearing, or when we are compelled to talk about things we would prefer to keep hidden. We display discomfort first in our physiology, due to arousal of the limbic brain. Our heart rate quickens, our hairs stand on end, we perspire more, and we breathe faster. Beyond the physiological responses, which are autonomic, automatic, and require no thinking on our part, Our bodies manifest discomfort non-verbally. We tend to move our bodies in an attempt to block or distance. We rearrange ourselves, jiggle our feet, fidget, twist at the hips, or drum our fingers when we are scared, nervous, or significantly uncomfortable. We have all noticed such discomfort behaviors in others, whether at a job interview, on a date, or when being questioned about a serious matter at work or home. Remember that these actions do not automatically indicate deception. However, they do indicate that a person is uncomfortable in the current situation for any number of reasons. If you are attempting to observe discomfort as a potential indicator of deception, the best setting is one that has no objects, such as furniture, tables, desks, or chairs, between you and the person you are observing or interviewing. Because we have noted that the lower limbs are particularly honest, if the person is behind a desk or a table, try to move it or convene away from it, as such an obstacle will block the vast majority, nearly 80%, of the body surfaces that should be observed. In fact, watch for liars to use obstacles or objects, such as a pillow, a drinking glass, or a chair, to form a barrier between you and them. The use of objects is a sign that an individual wants distance, separation, and partial concealment, because he or she is being less open, which goes hand in hand with being uncomfortable or even deceitful. Building the wall. In my role with the FBI years ago, I conducted a joint interview of a subject, along with an officer from a fellow law enforcement agency. During the interview, a very uncomfortable and dishonest man gradually built a barrier in front of himself using soda cans, pencil holders, and various documents that were on the desk of my interviewing partner. He ultimately planted a backpack on the table between himself and the interviewers. The building of this barrier was so gradual that we did not realize it until we later looked at the video. This nonverbal behavior occurred because the subject was attempting to derive comfort by hiding behind a wall of materials, thus distancing himself. Obviously, we got little information or cooperation, and for the most part, he lied. Incidentally, when it comes to interviewing or any conversation in which you are interested in ascertaining the truth or genuineness of a person's statements, you may gain more nonverbal information if you are standing. You can pick up on a lot of behaviors standing that simply go unnoticed while sitting. While a lengthy period of standing may be impractical or unnatural in some settings, such as at a formal job interview, there are often still opportunities to observe standing behaviors, such as when greeting or conversing while waiting for a table at lunch. When we are uncomfortable with those around us, we tend to distance ourselves from them. This is especially true of individuals trying to deceive us. Even while sitting side by side, we will lean away from those with whom we feel uncomfortable, often moving either our torsos or our feet away or toward an exit. These behaviors can occur during conversations either because of the difficult, unnerving, or sour relationship between the parties involved, or because of the subject matter being discussed. Other clear signs of discomfort seen in people during a difficult or troubling conversation include rubbing the forehead near the temple region, squeezing the face, rubbing the neck, or stroking the back of the head with the hand. People may show their displeasure by rolling their eyes in disrespect, picking lint off themselves, preening, or talking down to the person asking the questions, giving short answers, becoming resistant, hostile, or sarcastic, or even displaying microgestures with indecent connotations, such as giving the finger. Envision a snotty and indignant teenager who is being questioned about a new and expensive sweater her mother suspects was stolen from the mall, and you'll have a clear idea of all the defensive maneuvers an uncomfortable person can display. When making false statements, liars will rarely touch or engage in other physical contact with you. I found this to be particularly true of informants who had gone bad and were giving false information for money. Since touching is more often performed by the truthful person for emphasis, this distancing helps to alleviate the level of anxiety a dishonest person is feeling. Any diminution of touching observed in a person engaged in conversation, especially while hearing or answering critical questions, is more likely than not to be indicative of deception. If possible and appropriate, you may consider sitting close to a loved one when questioning him or her about something serious, or even holding your child's hand while you discuss a difficult matter. In this way, you may more readily note changes in touch throughout the conversation. A failure to touch does not automatically indicate someone is deceptive, however, and physical contact is clearly more appropriate and expected in some of our interpersonal relationships than others. It is true that a lack of touch may signify that someone does not like you, since we also don't touch those we don't respect or for whom we have contempt. The bottom line is that assessing the nature and length of the relationship is also important in discerning the meaning of such distancing behavior. When looking at the face for signs of comfort or discomfort, look for subtle behaviors such as a grimace or a look of contempt. Also, watch for a person's mouth to quiver or squirm in discomfort during a serious discussion. Any facial expression that lasts too long or lingers is not normal, whether a smile, a frown, or a surprised look. Such contrived behavior during a conversation or an interview is intended to influence opinion and lacks authenticity. Often when people are caught doing something wrong or lying, they will hold a smile for what seems an eternity. Rather than indicating comfort, this type of false smile is actually a discomfort display. When we do not like something we hear, whether a question or an answer, we often close our eyes as if to block out what was just heard. The various forms of eye-blocking mechanisms are analogous to folding our hands tightly across our chest or turning away from those with whom we disagree. These blocking displays are performed subconsciously and occur often, especially during a formal interview, and are usually related to a specific topic. Eyelid flutter is also observed at times when a particular subject causes distress. All of these eye manifestations are powerful clues as to how information is registering or what questions are problematic for the recipient. However, they are not necessarily direct indicators of deceit. Little or no eye contact is not indicative of deception. This is rubbish for reasons discussed in the previous chapter. Keep in mind that predators and habitual liars actually engage in greater eye contact than most individuals and will lock eyes with you. Research clearly shows that Machiavellian people, for example, psychopaths, con men, and habitual liars, will actually increase eye contact during deception. Perhaps this increase in eye contact is consciously employed by such individuals because it is so commonly but erroneously believed that looking someone straight in the eye is a sign of truthfulness. Be aware that there are cultural differences in eye contact and eye gaze behavior that must be considered in any attempt to detect deception. For example, individuals belonging to certain groups of people, African Americans and Latin Americans, for instance, may be taught to look down or away from parental authority out of respect when questioned or being scolded. Take note of the head movements of those with whom you are speaking. If a person's head begins to shake either in the affirmative or in the negative as he is speaking, and the movement occurs simultaneously with what he is saying, then the statement can typically be relied upon as being truthful. If, however, the head shake or head movement is delayed or occurs after the speech, then most likely the statement is contrived and not truthful. Although it may be very subtle, the delayed movement of the head is an attempt to further validate what has been stated and is not part of the natural flow of communication. In addition, Honest head movements should be consistent with verbal denials or affirmations. If a head movement is inconsistent with or contrary to a person's statement, it may indicate deception. While typically involving more subtle than exaggerated head movements, this incongruity of verbal and nonverbal signals happens more often than we think. For example, someone may say, "I didn't do it," while his head is slightly nodding in the affirmative. During discomfort, the limbic brain takes over, and a person's face can conversely either flush or lighten in color. During difficult conversations, you may also see increased perspiration or breathing. Note whether the person is noticeably wiping off sweat or trying to control his or her breathing in an effort to remain calm. Any trembling of the body, whether of the hands, fingers, or lips, or any attempt to hide or restrain the hands or lips through disappearing or compressed lips, may be indicative of discomfort and or deception, especially if it occurs after normal nervousness should have worn off. A person's voice may crack or may seem inconsistent during deceptive speech. Swallowing becomes difficult as the throat becomes dry from stress, so look for hard swallows. These can be evidenced by a sudden bob or jump of the Adam's apple, and may be accompanied by the clearing or repeated clearings of the throat, all indicative of discomfort. Keep in mind that these behaviors are indicators of distress, not guarantees of deception. I have seen very honest people testify in court displaying all these behaviors, simply because they were nervous, not because they were lying. Even after years of testifying in federal and state courts, I still get nervous when I am on the stand. So signs of tension and stress always need to be deciphered in context. Pacifiers and discomfort. When interviewing suspects during my years with the FBI, I looked for pacifying behaviors to help guide me in my questioning and to assess what was particularly stressful to the interviewee. Although pacifiers alone are not definitive proof of deception, since they can manifest in innocent people who are nervous, they do provide another piece of the puzzle in determining what a person is truly thinking and feeling. The following is a list of 12 things I do and the points I keep in mind when I want to read pacifying nonverbals in interpersonal interactions. You might consider using a similar strategy when you interview or converse with others, be it a formal inquiry, a serious conversation with a family member, or an interaction with a business associate. 1. Get a clear view. When I conduct interviews or interact with others, I don't want anything blocking my total view of the person, as I don't want to miss any pacifying behaviors. If, for example, the person pacifies by wiping his hands on his lap, I want to be able to see it, which is difficult if there is a desk in the way. Human resource personnel should be aware that the best way to interview is in a physically open space, with nothing blocking your view of the candidate, so you may fully observe the person you are interviewing. 2. Expect some pacifying behaviors. A certain level of pacifying behavior is normal in everyday nonverbal displays. People do this to calm themselves. When my daughter was young, she would soothe herself to sleep by playing with her hair, curling the strands in her fingers, seemingly oblivious to the world. So I expect people to pacify more or less throughout the day, just as I expect them to breathe, as they adapt to an ever-changing environment. 3. Expect initial nervousness. Initial nervousness in an interview or serious conversation is normal, particularly when circumstances surrounding the meeting are stressful. For example, a father asking his son about his homework assignment will not be as stressful as asking the boy why he was expelled from school for disruptive behavior. 4. Get the person with whom you're interacting to relax first. As an interview, important meeting, or significant discussion progresses, eventually those involved should calm down and become more comfortable. In fact, a good interviewer will make sure this happens by taking time to let the person become more relaxed before asking questions or exploring topics that might be stressful. 5. Establish a baseline. Once a person's pacifying behaviors have decreased and stabilized to normal for that person, the interviewer can use that pacifying level as a baseline for assessing future behavior. 6. Look for increased use of pacifiers. As the interview or conversation continues, you should be observant of pacifying behaviors and or an increase, spike, in their frequency, particularly when they occur in response to a specific question or piece of information. Such an increase is a clue that something about the question or information has troubled the person pacifying, and that topic likely deserves further attention and focus. It is important to identify correctly the specific stimulus, whether a question, information, or event, that caused the pacifying response. Otherwise, you might draw the wrong conclusions or move the discussion in the wrong direction. For example, if during an employment interview the candidate starts to ventilate his shirt collar, a pacifier, when asked a certain question about his former position, that specific inquiry has caused sufficient stress that his brain is requiring pacification. This indicates the issue needs to be pursued further. The behavior does not necessarily mean that deception is involved, but simply that the topic is causing the interviewee stress. 7. Ask, pause, and observe. Good interviewers, like good conversationalists, do not machine gun questions by firing one right after the other in a staccato fashion. You will be hard-pressed to detect deception accurately if your impatience or impertinence antagonizes the person with whom you are speaking. Ask a question, and then wait to observe all the reactions. Give the interviewee time to think and respond, and build in pregnant pauses to achieve this objective. Also, questions should be crafted in such a way as to elicit specific answers in order to better zero in on facts and fiction. The more specific the question, the more likely you are to elicit precise nonverbals. And now that you have better understanding of the meaning of subconscious actions, the more accurate your assessments will be. In law enforcement interviews, unfortunately, many false confessions have been obtained through sustained staccato-like questioning, which causes high stress and obfuscates nonverbal cues. We now know that innocent people will confess to crimes and even give written statements in order to terminate a stressful interview wherein pressure is applied. The same holds true for sons, daughters, spouses, friends, and employees when grilled by an overzealous person, be it a parent, husband, wife, companion, or boss. 8. Keep the person you are interviewing focused. Interviewers should keep in mind that many times when people are simply talking, when they are telling their side of the story, there will be fewer useful nonverbals performed than when the interviewer controls the scope of the topic. Pointed questions elicit behavioral manifestations that are useful in assessing a person's honesty. 9. Chatter is not truth. One mistake made by both novice and experienced interviewers is the tendency to equate talking with truth. When interviewees are talking, we tend to believe them. When they are reserved, we assume they are lying. During a conversation, people who provide an overwhelming amount of information and detail about an event or situation may appear to be telling the truth. However, they may be presenting a fabricated smokescreen they hope will obfuscate the facts or lead the conversation in another direction. The truth is revealed not in the volume of material spoken, but through the verification of facts provided by the speaker. Until the information is verified, it is self-reported and perhaps meaningless data. It's all a lie. I remember one case in which I interviewed a woman in Macon, Georgia. For 3 days, she voluntarily provided us with page after page of information. I really felt we were on to something when the interview was finally over, until it came time to corroborate what this woman had said. For over a year, we investigated her claims, both in the United States and in Europe. But in the end, after expending significant effort and resources, we discovered that everything she had told us was a lie. She had provided us pages and pages of plausible lies, even implicating her innocent husband. Had I remembered that cooperation does not always equal truth, and had I scrutinized her more carefully, we would have been spared wasting a great deal of time and money. The information this woman had given sounded good and seemed plausible, but it was all trash. I wish I could say this incident happened to me early in my career, but it did not. I am neither the first, nor will I be the last, interviewer to be bamboozled this way. Though some people naturally talk more than others, you should always be on the lookout for this kind of chatty ploy. 10. Stress coming in and going out. Based on years of studying interviewee behavior, I have concluded that a person with guilty knowledge will present two distinct behavior patterns in sequence when asked a difficult question, such as, "Did you ever go inside the home of Mr. Jones?" The first behavior will reflect the stress experienced when hearing the question. The interviewee will subconsciously respond with various distancing behaviors, including foot withdrawal, moving them away from the investigator. He may lean away or may tighten his jaw and lips. This will be followed by the second set of related behaviors, pacifying responses to the stress that may include signals such as neck touching, nose stroking, or neck massaging as he ponders the question or answer. 11. Isolate the cause of the stress. Two behavior patterns in series, the stress indicators followed by pacifying behaviors, have traditionally been erroneously associated with deception. This is unfortunate, because these manifestations need to be explained more simply as what they are, indicators of stress and stress relief, not necessarily dishonesty. No doubt someone who is lying may display these same behaviors, but individuals who are nervous also show them. Occasionally, I will hear someone say, "If people talk while touching their nose, they are lying." It may be true that people who are deceptive touch their nose while speaking, but so do individuals who are honest but under stress. The nose touching is a pacifying behavior to relieve internal tension, regardless of the source of that discomfort. Even a retired FBI agent who was stopped for speeding with no legitimate explanation will touch his nose when pulled over. "Yes, I paid the ticket." My point is this. Don't be so hasty to assume deception when you see someone touching his or her nose. For everyone who does it while lying, you will find 100 who do it out of habit to relieve stress. 12. Pacifiers say so much. By helping us identify when a person is stressed, pacifying behaviors help us identify issues that need further focus and exploration. Through effective questioning, we can both elicit and identify these pacifiers in any interpersonal interaction to achieve a better understanding of a person's thoughts and intentions. Two principal nonverbal behavioral patterns to consider in detecting deception. When it comes to body signals that alert us to the possibility of deception, you should be watching for nonverbal behaviors involving synchrony and emphasis. Synchrony. Earlier in this chapter, I discussed the importance of synchrony as a way to assess for comfort in interpersonal interaction. Synchrony is also important, however, in assessing for deception. Look for synchrony between what is being said verbally and nonverbally, between the circumstances of the moment and what the subject is saying, between events and emotions, and even synchrony of time and space. When being questioned, a person answering in the affirmative should have congruent head movement that immediately supports what is said. It should not be delayed. Lack of synchrony is exhibited when a person states, I did not do it, while her head is nodding in an affirmative motion. Likewise, asynchrony is demonstrated when a man is asked, would you lie about this? And his head gives a slight nod while he answers,